I'd like now to welcome Brian Arthur. He is an external professor and, in fact, one of the founders of the Santa Fe Institute, and he's a visiting scholar at the Intelligent Systems Laboratory at PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center. He's author of the book, The Nature of Technology, What It Is and How It Evolves. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Delighted to be here.
So let's talk about the evolution of technology. This is something that you talk about and explore the question of how it's like and how it's different from biological evolution. First of all, when we talk about technology, there are a lot of different ways to define technology.
Right. Well, I'm interested in a very broad definition of technology. Anything that's a means to a human purpose. So that could be traffic lights. It could be a handheld device. It could be MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, or X-rays. It could be a surgical procedure. There's many, many different things qualify as technologies. My interest was always, where does it all come from?
What's interesting about technology is that there are a lot of things that are almost technologies, like if you, for example, develop a way to learn a language quickly.
Yeah.
There's not a device necessarily, but it's still a method to fulfill a human purpose and to do it more quickly than you were able to do it before.
Yeah, a lot of things are means or methods to fulfill a human purpose. I'm interested in all of those. So I don't want to draw a line and say, you know, I'm only interested in electronic technologies, or I'm only interested in things you could buy on Amazon as electronic devices. As humans, we've created an awful lot of means to further our own purposes, most of them pretty good and all of them quite complicated, and I'm interested in them all. Occasionally they get a bit wild, like is a Mahler symphony a means to fulfill a human purpose? I believe it is. Mahler believed it was. And so for me, that's a method or a technology. It's a means to give people auditory pleasure, if you like.
And acting would be a technology.
Yes.
To make people feel, and we use, I mean, the same root is technique.
Yeah, that's right. Techne in Greek really means art, the art of doing something.
Are there taxonomies of technology the way they are in biological evolution?
Yeah, well, there's broad families of technology. Usually a technology exploits some phenomenon, so the phenomenon could be an optical one or a chemical one, or it could be a whole mixture of things. It could be a genetic one. So we have, say, gene sequencing that exploits genetic phenomena. We have various technologies such as cell phones that exploit or use electronic phenomena and electrical phenomena, etc. So there's broad taxonomies depending on exactly what type of phenomenon you're using from nature. Some effects are even social. You know, if I give you a piece of paper and we both have trust that that piece of paper says $5 on it, and somebody's going to fulfill a promise that that is worth $5, then that's a means to a human purpose known as money or paper money, and that might just be a social phenomenon that we all agree that that piece of paper is worth $5.
So you could make entire family trees of technology,
yeah,
really the way you can of the kingdom of animals that have birds and mammals and all sorts of things in them.
Well, that's been a huge question, and this was a kind of a quest for me. Ever since Darwin's book in 1859, people have been wondering, you know, Darwin was very convincing in the mid-1800s that we had all creatures, the whole zoology of animals that are out there, plants as well, had all somehow descended from some ancestral family tree. It may have been huge, with many twigs on it and many things that never came through to our day, but it was one vast thicket of family trees that branched into whole groups of animals, plants, and other organisms. Now, the question for people in engineering or technology or science was, is there such a family tree or an ancestry for all technologies? So when I say evolution, I'm not just saying that, you know, some technology like the cell phone changes. You know, in 1990, it was a big clunky device. Now it's a smartphone with many apps on it. So clearly, any individual technology changes over its lifetime. But I'm talking about a much bigger question. Could you take a cell phone? Could you take other technologies and go back in time and find common ancestry? Where has it all come from? Is it all dreamed up out of nothing, or has it come from some background of technologies giving birth to new technologies?
And?
Well, there's been an awful lot of attempts to figure out how technology has evolved in that larger sense. And they all came a cropper because, in the past anyway, because they were trying to say it's very Darwinian, it's like Darwin's mechanism. That would mean that things, you know, when something like the airplane comes out, there's a lot of variations of that, and the better variations are selected, and that gives birth to better aircraft in the 1920s and Second World War jet fighters and so on. So a fair amount of that does go on in technology, but that argument didn't work because occasionally you get these massively disruptive technologies. It just seemed to come out of nowhere.
What do you mean by disruptive?
Well, hugely different, working on a different principle. So suddenly there comes along the jet engine in the late 1920s and early 30s, and there's no way you can say the jet engine, the thing we see, you know, on all airplanes these days, passenger aircraft, there's no way we can say that that came out of variations of standard piston engines, what went before. Similarly, in the 30s, we get radar, is a method for detecting, in those days, aircraft, possibly enemy aircraft, maybe 20, 30 miles away. And that, there's no way that came out of standard radio circuits. It wasn't as if people varied radio circuits and suddenly somebody said, oh, we've got radar. Radar is a totally different principle. So it's as if you get dinosaurs, 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 and then something very different comes out, completely different. And so technology does evolve in a different way, and that's what interested me.
From somebody who's not a scientist looking at it from the outside, biological evolution looks like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a series of brilliant creative innovation and radical jumps. I mean, there were fish swimming around in the water and suddenly there's creatures on the land, or there were things walking around and suddenly they were flying.
Yeah.
And that looks like the same kind of jump as the jet engine.
Well, they do look like jumps, but actually, the deeper you get into it, the more you can see. In fact, Darwin said it's by the steady accumulation of small changes that we get new species. I was shocked to read in one of Dawkins's books, Richard Dawkins, that he gave a long account of how whales had slowly evolved from hippopotamuses. And, you know, whales are shockingly different looking from hippopotamuses. But nevertheless, according to Dawkins, I'm sure this is held up pretty well, they slowly accumulated small changes. The hippopotamuses began to swim. My recollection must have been around 9 million years ago, if I remember the facts right, and took to the water, and then being weightless, they were able to reform and their legs attenuated, etc. But if you look at the anatomy or the DNA, you can see the ancestry very clearly. So the point is, in biology, it may look like very abrupt change, But actually, it has to go incrementally, because there isn't anything saying we can just snap our fingers and get a big change. If it's all done by parents to offspring, to their offspring, and anything that would be a big change usually would not survive. Technology doesn't work that way. It wasn't as if piston engine designers, you know, the standard up until the late 1920s, a piston engine, very similar to the kind of thing we have in our car, an aero piston engine, had many cylinders and pistons pumping in and out, and they needed to get more oxygen to fly planes at high altitudes, and so they fitted it out with all kinds of contraptions, superchargers to pump in air at high altitude and so on. And then comes along the jet engine. That's totally different. It works on a very different principle. It doesn't have pistons at all. So it's as if that offspring, it wasn't an offspring from the piston engine, it was quite different. And when it was proposed to the people who knew about air piston engines, they found it almost absurd. Quite famously, they said, well, you know, maybe you can do this, but this is ridiculous. Plus, it won't be anywhere near as good as the engines we now have, so why bother? So you get these very sudden changes with technology, disruptive changes, and something completely different.
We're talking to Brian Arthur. So how do those sudden, abrupt, disruptive changes come into being? I mean, is this the mystery of human creativity?
Well, you could say it's the mystery of human creativity, and a lot of the literature that I looked at when I was writing my book and researching this, by the way, most of the research I did was in Santa Fe, a great deal of it at St. John's College in the library.
Is that right?
Fantastic place to work, as well as the Institute, the Santa Fe Institute here. But these disruptive changes, when I was saying most of the literature sort of says, well, something very creative happens, and then whoever's writing that kind of waves their hands. But if you look at what happens very creatively, usually there's a very strong need. Britain, for example, in the mid-1930s, felt it could be invaded from the continent, possibly by the Germans, with aircraft. And they had acoustic devices. They had blind people near the coast listening with ear trumpets, so to speak, that were enormous, big concrete affairs that led to somebody's ear. And yes, you could hear aircraft coming 10 or 15 miles off, but that was regarded as a bit iffy. And so they were looking for something radically different and radically new. And usually what happens is that there's a strong felt need from somewhere. We need a different principle. We need a different key idea. And the key idea, many ideas are usually bandied about and thought about different principles. Well, we could do this, we could do that. But usually, or pretty well always, there's a core principle. In the case of radar, people knew that if you bounced very high frequency radio waves off something metal quite far away, the radio waves would give off an echo, and you could pick up that echo, just as if I could bounce my voice off some cliff that's 2 miles away and then wait for an echo. And it was that principle that people started to say, well, how could we send out such a high frequency pulse? How could we listen for it and detect it? Once we detect it, how do we know how far away the thing is? So they started to solve all those problems. So what really happens is that invention, or coming up with some radically novel technology, isn't inspiration, it's problem solving. And it's not that different from the kind of problem solving we do in real life. You know, I might lose my wallet. I'm thinking, oh God, well, if I want to get back to the airport, they're going to want my driver's license. So how do I deal with that? Well, I'd better make some phone calls. I'll do this, I'll do that. And so we confront this sort of thing, searching for different principles, ideas of something we can use. But once we get a key idea, let's bounce radio waves off these aircraft and see if we can pick up an echo. Once we get that, we have to purify, make the idea work, purify it, amplify it, listen to how that would work, set it up in different components, instrument it, make it work. And that might take 2 or 3 years to get all the pieces and parts to work.
And in wartime, the goal is to have it work so that you can fulfill your need. In peacetime, it's to have it work and be economic enough that you can sell lots of them.
Oh, you bet. Yes, certainly. One of the examples I did a lot of research on, actually, for better or worse, was the atomic bomb in Los, you know, it was produced here locally. But again, I don't want to comment on the moral side of that, but I do want to say that the basic principle was around since about 1936, but putting all the parts together to make that work took another 6, 7, 8 years before most of this was realized in hardware. So invention or coming up with radically new technologies is a form of problem solving. And one problem, you could say, well, I can solve the overall problem if I could solve this sub-problem. I could solve the sub-problem if I could solve this sub-sub-problem. It's a bit like doing Sudoku or solving some puzzle, where if you can get one part to work, a different part will work. And it's recursive. You go back and forth between problem and possible solutions. In that sense, it's very creative because you're searching your mind over all the whole quiver or menu of solutions, types that you know, whole functionalities. And in the end, what you wind up with is a combination. So we say, what really is radar? Well, it's a combination of things that were around before radar. You know, radio circuits, high-frequency oscillators, detection devices, etc. Very little of radar had to be, very few components had to be composed from scratch. Radar or cell phones or anything else you like are always in the end put together from pieces or from technologies that already exist.
So in that sense, what seems like a big radical jump forward is made up of lots of little incremental pieces, like biological evolution in some ways.
Yes, that's right. But there is a difference. It's a bit like saying if all of technologies are like a big set of Lego blocks, and I create, I say, oh, okay, I can take some of these red pieces and the black pieces and a few of those small yellow ones, I can create a new technology, you know, call it radio or radar or something else, and I have a new combination. But then if that new combination is useful, like radio is, maybe I can use that as a new fancy Lego block to create yet further things.
And so it's like there's a, in your book, there's this nice parable about a watchmaker. And if you have one watchmaker who puts together a watch with 1,000 different pieces, and another one who makes little assemblages of 100 pieces and then puts them together, that's more the way technology works. You have all these little assemblages of technology that's come before, and then we recombine them.
Yes, that's really a story that was put out by Herb Simon. It's a beautiful little story. It's basically about modules, that you could make things from 1,000 separate parts, but we find it more useful or much more realistic to make small modules. Those themselves might be technologies. And then some of those modules are useful to make yet further technologies. So technology is built up from the start by very simple building blocks with elementary phenomena like fire, maybe you can store energy in a bent deer's antler. Maybe sooner or later that becomes a bow or for bow and arrow. We can use heavy stone to pound or to grind. So those are very basic technologies. And if you look at all technologies, they're combinations of what went before. We might have a wooden stick, and we might have some, vine or leather type piece of binding, and we might have some sort of sharpened stone to use as an axe head. And then we get the idea of binding or hafting the sharpened stone to a piece of wood, and we have an elementary axe. Once we have an axe, we can do yet further things.
And so, next thing you know, you've got a cell phone.
Well, a few hundred thousand years later, probably, or at least 100,000 years later. But what fascinates me about all of this is that technology is basically building blocks that once in a while, not every single day, but once in a while, create new building blocks. And that goes into the Lego set, and yet more things can be constructed out of that. And occasionally you could say, well, you know, surely we, don't we discover new phenomena sometimes, you know, the quantum phenomena or the genetic phenomena, and we make technologies out of those. Yes, but to discover those and to harness those phenomena, we are using bits and pieces that we already have. We're using lenses, we're using microscopes, we're using digital circuitry, we're using things that we already possess.
And we're using mathematics.
We're using mathematics, certainly, and other methods. So to come back to the original question then, you know, is there a theory of evolution of technology? I believe so, and that's what I've written in my book. And it's not a neat tree like Darwin's tree, nor does it work exactly like Darwin said. It's somewhat different. It's basically all about making new combinations from what already exists. And so a new technology, again, something, say, like a laser printer, which was developed at Park where I work. It's basically using a laser to write on a Xerox drum. A new technology is put together, as I said, from what already exists. So it uses a laser, a computer, and a Xerox machine. And so all of technology is develops by putting these combinations together. And that means a new technology doesn't just have a two ancestors, you know, mom and dad. It has maybe, one or two dozen parent technologies that made it possible.
Right.
A laser printer's made possible by the fact that lasers existed, computers existed, and Xerox machines existed. And we can put them together to use a laser to write on a Xerox drum and get beautiful printing out.
When you follow it back to, lenses, and then, going way back to bows and arrows and stones and things like that, the basic building blocks of all technology are the physical and chemical and biological laws of the earth that we live on.
That's right. Yeah. All technologies use some effect or some phenomenon. And if there's a general rule, if there's no phenomenon, there's nothing you can do. And I'm always fascinated, if you take away just one phenomenon, you know, we're somewhat at sea. For example, if you go out into space and you take away gravity, it's surprising how many things that we just naturally rely on don't work as easily. It's hard to drink a glass of water. You have to think of ways around things that don't use gravity. It's hard even to use a ballpoint pen. There's a certain amount of gravity is necessary for that, etc.
So the evolution of technology is dependent on those phenomena, and really so is our biological evolution.
Yes, all of what we've done as human beings, I think, is something absolutely marvelous. We have learned to use natural phenomena, and if you want to be a bit poetic about it, we've learned to orchestrate them. You know, if you take any technology, say like a jet engine, I'm going to be flying back tomorrow on Southwest Airlines. But a jet engine consists of maybe, 20 or 30,000 separate parts or separate sub-technologies that all of have to work in unison, almost like a symphony orchestra.
And or like our digestive system.
Like our digestive system or like our immune system. And parts have to switch on and switch off and switch in and out. And it all must be extremely reliable. So the marvelous thing that we've done as human beings, and I think it is a marvel, and for me it's a wonder, is that we have captured these phenomena and we've learned to use them. And not only that, we've learned to orchestrate them and we've learned to use them in some cohesive, coherent way that we can do absolutely marvelous things. We can also do nefarious things, but for the most part, we've done pretty well with technology. Other animals do use some technologies. Think of beavers and dams. But above all, our species have been the ones that have captured, tamed, used, and orchestrated phenomena to our purposes. And out of that, we get music, we get literature, we get air travel, we get, if you're in hospital, all the 64,000 or so recognized surgical procedures that the AMA classifies. So it's been amazing, and that's what's allowed us, more than anything, as human beings to flourish.
We're talking to Santa Fe Institute founder and professor Brian Arthur. He's author of the book, The Nature of Technology, What It Is and How It Evolves. It seems to me, again, as a non-scientist looking at your work, that technology is really just an extension of biological evolution in some ways. I mean, you think about a bird evolving sharp claws with which it can capture its prey, and you think of us developing bows and arrows with which we can capture our prey, and it's the same kind of instinct to develop useful apparatuses, whether they be part of our bodies or extensions of our bodies.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely correct, and what we've managed to do as human beings is, you know, biologically we're pretty well multi-purpose machines, we're multi-purpose organisms. We don't have sharp beaks, and we might have sharp nails, but we're not that highly specialized. Instead, what we've done over millennia, hundreds of millennia, I'm sure, is being able to capture some of these phenomena and use them externally. So not as part of our bodies, but things that we can pick up and use. It's like Kubrick's movie 2001, where the chimpanzee picked up a bone and found it could bash something with the bone and use the bone as a hammer. And from there on, for better or worse, we haven't looked back. But it defines our species more than anything, this external use of nature, not making it part of our bodies.
So when we think about natural selection in nature, there are organisms that are selected for because they've got traits that are adaptive and they reproduce, and other ones die off before they reach the age of reproduction. What is natural selection, or what is the equivalent of natural selection in technology?
Well, there's a lot of selection, but for these radically different technologies that I'm talking about, there's plenty of natural selection. You know, if you get a better helicopter design, the market likes it and that gets selected, and future designers use some version of that better design.
And so, they try to make it affordable, and that's part
of it. And that's very Darwinian. The part that isn't Darwinian is where you get these radically novel technologies, and that's really putting together existing technologies in a new and different way, and sometimes a very unexpected way. So it's as if it was open to biology, say, to take the neck of a giraffe and the hide of a rhinoceros and maybe the bill of a platypus and put together some new animal that would be marvelously adapted for some weird circumstance. That happens in the very low levels of certain types of bacteria called horizontal gene transfer. There is that sort of combination of bits and parts, but at least in the higher organisms, the more complicated ones, we don't see that. What we see is small changes have to accumulate. It's much of what happens in technology too. Small changes do accumulate, but occasionally radically different things are suddenly put together. If you look at your cell phone, it's basically a screen just like you have in your computer. That's put together with some sort of acoustic device, microphones, with a processor, with memory, all kinds of things that are just lifted out of computer technology, out of television technology, out of acoustic technology, and they're all slapped together, not randomly, not haphazardly, but with great thought and great design. And once that first cell phone is thought up, then small variations on that can happen. But for the radically different technologies, that's radical combination of things that exist already. And that doesn't exist in the animal kingdom, at least.
One thing that we do is we imitate the natural world. There's this whole world of technological invention called biomimicry.
Right. Well, I think that, over eons, the natural world has discovered many, many ways it can solve certain problems. You know, if you look at certain types of, salamanders or lizards can climb vertical walls and so on. And there are certain absolutely marvelous structures, bone structures, say, that birds would have that give their bones great strength, but yet preserve an enormous amount of lightness. And one thing engineers delight in doing is looking at how nature has solved those problems and then seeing if they can mimic that with material technologies in the standard world.
You work in this place in Palo Alto and in Silicon Valley that is all about inventing things all the time. Is innovation helped by interdisciplinary contact? I mean, there's clearly people who are intensely specialized in whatever their field is.
Yeah, to make anything work is, to solve those problems, very often you think, well, I could get this piece to work if I could solve that puzzle. But that's an optical puzzle, and I don't know much about optics. And in Silicon Valley, why Silicon Valley works so well, or Park, where I am, is that normally you can walk down a corridor and find somebody who does know. You know somebody in the organization who knows somebody. There's only a few hundred people, and somebody, not always, but nearly always, somebody knows and has maybe solved that sort of problem. So what fascinates me about technology is we tend to think it's scientific, but it is scientific, but it's also what I call deep craft. It's a set of knowings that reside within human beings, and these, just like you know how to get from A to B in Santa Fe, and you know about radio and radio programs and so on, in Silicon Valley somebody might know how to do a certain type of micron level etching on a material, somebody else might know how to do purification of certain types of materials so it doesn't have anomalies. Somebody might know how to do high frequency modulation on something. And having all those at your fingertips is really good. It's like having a bunch of experts. It's basically phone a friend. And you can do that up and down the corridors in Silicon Valley. That's why something like Silicon Valley works. Austin, Texas, Ann Arbor, Michigan, the area around MIT, because there's a huge concentration of people who know the answers to problems. And if you don't know yourself and you're trying to combine things and make things work that way, you can always find somebody who does know the answer.
We're talking to Brian Arthur, professor at the Santa Fe Institute and author of the book, The Nature of Technology, What It Is and How It Evolves. One of the things that is so weird and apparently mysterious, again, to the non-scientist, is in nature, what it looks like is that some people sat around and said, you know, it would really help if we could perceive the world around us. Let's make an eye. But we have some of the components, but what do we really need to do to make this work? Well, let's see. Let's put together a retina and a cornea. Let's put together some tears and let's make the thing tough and resilient, but also completely moist all the time and give it an aperture to close and open depending on how light and dark it is. I mean, it's an amazing piece of technology. When humans do it, it's intentional. When nature does it, it's not intentional, but it looks so similar in process.
Well, yeah, and I think what nature has managed to do for me is a source of huge wonder, you know, that something as magnificent as a human eye or any other sort of eye, an octopus eye, it's quite amazing, a hawk's eye, you know, the acuity is marvelous. But don't forget that it took nature maybe tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of years to get there. With technology, essentially, we've only been doing this well, what we do, for the last 300 years, two or 300 years. And it is a matter of picking up pieces you know from there and transporting them over here and so on. When people were fooling around with cameras about 100 years ago or more, you know, you wanted to have a pretty large lens, but then that lens needed correcting, so you needed other lenses. And then you needed to have an aperture thing that, much like the human iris, that could expand or contract, etc., etc. And some of that was inspired probably by biology, but we had to find those pieces within the technologies we already had. And so this is, again and again, I want to stress that new technologies are not a matter of genius or inspiration. Of course, they're dreamed up by smart people, but it's not just pure inspiration. There's an element of inspiration. It's actually finding something in what exists already. And, you know, people who cook up a new piece of music are usually finding a theme and expressing that in terms of other themes and other musical expressions or maybe even rhythms that are out there already. They're doing combination.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you could map the evolution of technology and the evolution of the arts and things like that onto similar...
Yes, I think doing art well, like composing music, composing poetry, is not at all different from technology. For example, if I'm composing poetry, I don't do that, but if I were, I would be looking to express some feeling or some nuanced way of looking at the world. And I would be taking expressions and ideas and trying to put those together using words and expressions that I'm familiar with and speaking English and are available to me already. So in a way, I come back to the same thing. I'm finding what I want within what exists already. I'm rummaging through my box of words, expressions, phrases, putting those together. Doing technology isn't different from doing poetry. Doing it well is like doing good poetry, and there's plenty of not-so-good technology out there, too, just as there's plenty of other not so good architecture, not so good music, etc.
We're talking to Brian Arthur. I think one of the things that's so interesting about technology is it's such a clear expression of our human nature, and yet there's a lot of discussion of how technology disconnects us from nature.
Yeah. Well, this is something that worries me. It's worried. It's also worried great philosophers for quite a long time. There's an odd thing, and that is as we discover new technologies or invent them, like the railway train or the passenger aircraft, CAT scanning, you know, CT scans in hospitals, we always ask ourselves just how natural is this? And there's an unfamiliarity at first. And we sort of hold off and say, oh, I'm not sure I like this. And I must say, personally, maybe I'm just getting to an age, but I'm not so sure that I'm that happy that I get, say, 20 or 30 emails every day. I would prefer to live in an era where if people wanted to write me a letter, I could get two or three a day and wouldn't have to answer all those things. So there's a good side and a bad side. What strikes me is that I think fundamentally we distrust technology because we have a deep conflict. It's not just, is this technology good or bad? Is this technology worth it or not? Do we really want to be able to go into space or mess up this or that? Will we pollute this or that? It's deeper than that. For I think that there's a conflict between nature and technology. So let me explain that for a moment. We deeply, deeply, deeply hope in technology. So if I have a hope that my children will live fruitful lives and have children themselves and grandchildren, or that I live a long time and live prosperously, I'm basically hoping that the technology that we have will keep the economy running, that everything will work just fine. My hope is in technology. But, you know, we're humans, and we have had maybe a few hundred years worth of acclimatization to fairly advanced technologies, like wearing glasses or something. That's not that old. But we have 1, 2, 3 million years worth, as long as our species has existed, worth of experience with nature. So we hope in technology, but we trust in nature. And I think that as I watch movie after movie come out about technology, some of them like the movie AI or the movie Star Wars. These movies are usually contrasting technology. I'm always interested in Star Wars because technology, as I see it, is the Death Star in Star Wars. It regiments people. The people involved in the Death Star are all clones. They've been bled of humanity. They're all dressed in white, they've no color to them. There's no color to their characters. They all behave much the same way. The good guys have technology too, but their technologies are natural. So Chewbacca, Han Solo, those guys have technology, but they have to kind of kick it to get it started. So we're at home with technology, providing we feel it's natural. We're not at home with technology if we think it's doing something unnatural. And I think that's what causes a lot of the great debates that we have in our culture. Is stem cell technology, is that natural? Is such and such nuclear power, is that natural, etc.? And so we have these debates, and it takes us decades to settle those debates, and we may or may not accept the technology. It's not clear.
Well, there's also a question with any one of these technologies was what was the impetus for developing it in the first place?
Yeah.
And I think that's an important question. For example, a nuclear bomb was invented to kill hundreds of thousands of people in a second. Or another technology might be invented to sell as many pieces as we possibly can in a short time, because it turns out that this video game is really addictive for children between the ages of 4 and 9. And they've figured that out through psychology and through this whole technological process. And those are not great motivations for inventing something.
I completely agree with you. I think that quite often we're like 10-year-olds and we're sitting with a Lego box and we put pieces together and we get something that we like for the moment. We just say, oh, wow, that's incredible. Look what we can do. And then maybe a couple of decades later, we might regret what we've done. So I think that we're still in a phase as human beings where if something can be done, we tend to do it. And I would like to see us being much more thoughtful about the longer term, say, if we do such and such, for example, we start to collect huge amounts of data, which is happening on, you know, if we use our cell phones, if I use frequent buyer card in a grocery store, lots of data is being collected on me. That is a technology. That's what can be done at the moment. But we need to stand back and, we need some adult supervision and ask in advance, just how good an idea is this? And have public debates on it, and not just accept something, some new technology because we can do it. We need to make a distinction between what we can do and what we should do. And we haven't had that sort of debate very much. We have it in the medical sphere, but outside that we don't have it very much.
What would be the forum for that kind of a debate?
Oh, I think it's a public debate that we should have. And at the moment, with large corporations developing the technology, such as you mentioned, children's games and digital game technology, we're not having very open debates about all of that. Sure, there's always some debate, but I think that I don't want to see heavy government supervision, what can be done and what can't be done. But at the other end of the spectrum, we shouldn't accept something just because a corporation can sell us a bunch of game boxes. I think somewhere in the middle, there should be a bit of debate. And we had that sort of debate in the past, you know, what is acceptable socially? What do we want as a society? How do we want to organize ourselves? Do we want buses screaming around at, you know, 60 miles an hour through town? No, we don't. We have speed limits. So in many different areas of life, we've thought things out. It shouldn't be any different with technology.
Brian Arthur is one of the founders of the Santa Fe Institute. He's an external professor here, and he's a visiting scholar at the Intelligent Systems Laboratory at PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center. He's the author of the book, The Nature of Technology, What It Is and How It Evolves. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I'm delighted. Thank you.